This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. On this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at concerns around police corruption and media freedom. Our special guest is an award-winning journalist who's been at the centre of recent controversy regarding clandestine efforts by both the police and security services in attempts to access his confidential sources. But before we do, let's get a rundown on what seems to be a recurring theme within policing institutions.
In 2014, Theresa May, the then British Home Secretary, commissioned a public inquiry into allegations that undercover police officers had spied on the family of Stephen Lawrence during their campaign to compel police to investigate the racist murder of their son. May called the revelations profoundly shocking and disturbing. Retired Judge Sir John Meading was appointed to examine the conduct of officers who'd spied on more than 1,000 political groups between 1968 and at least 2010. In June, Meading's first report was published, arising out of the inquiry's work and what has now become known as the Spy Cop scandal. It also followed revelations that undercover officers were regularly involved in long-term sexual relationships with women during this time. At least four of the undercover officers are known or alleged to have fathered children with women they met during their work. In July this year, more revelations have been uncovered, this time with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, into allegations that they had obtained the authorisation to access telephone records of journalist Barry McCaffrey, after he approached the PSNI's press office in 2013 with questions for a story he was working on about alleged corruption in the police force. McCaffrey was later arrested along with fellow journalist Trevor Burney after a documentary they were both involved in exploring the role of police collusion into the deaths of six civilians in Loughan Island in 1994 uncovered a cover-up into the killings. These latest allegations once again shine a spotlight into a police force that has been at the centre of a number of controversies since it was reformed and renamed following the Patton Inquiry's recommendations in 2001.
As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest is award-winning journalist Barry McCaffrey. Many of you might remember Barry from the film No Stone Unturned, an explosive expose that shone the spotlight on British state collusion in the massacre of six civilians who were watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy at the World Cup in June 1994. Instead of Barry's investigative work imploring the police to examine the findings and prosecute the suspects, he and fellow journalist Trevor Burney became the focus of police attention. This led to both men being arrested in August 2018, only to be later vindicated and awarded damages. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
Firstly, Barry, how did you become a journalist?
Just by chance, Sean. I had work experience at school. I was lucky enough to end up in the Irish News. You know, it was 1985. Computers hadn't come in then. It was still typewriters and Tippex and things like that. Then it's during summer holidays volunteered for the Irish Times. It used to be in Phantom House in Belfast, and ended up working on building sites in Jersey in the late 80s and early 90s, and eventually came home, was doing a night class just for the headspace to do something, and somebody ended up saying that they were going to do a journalist course, and I just followed them. So it was just always by chance, you know.
Barry, we're going to talk a wee bit about your work on the film No Stone Unturned, but before we do that, we're going to have a wee look at the trailer for the film.
The World Cup Finals. I'd say the biggest day in Irish international soccer history.
Slaughter in Lochan Island as loyalist terrorists shoot 11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television.
And I just remember Mummy saying to us that bad men had come into the pub and the shop.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli army confirms the loss of 24 more troopers in intense clashes with Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza in the past day. The Yemeni army says that a fresh U.S.-led airstrikes on multiple targets in Yemen will not go unanswered and unpunished. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution calling on Islamic countries to cut vital lifelines of the Israeli regime over its aggression against Gaza. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Israel confirming more deaths among its forces in battles with Palestinian resistance fighters on the ground in the Gaza Strip. A military spokesman of the regime says 24 soldiers were killed in intense fighting in Gaza on Monday. 21 of them died after a rocket-propelled grenade hit a building they were in. Three others were killed in another operation to target an Israeli tank with a mortar shell. More than a dozen troops were also injured on the same day. Latest fatalities pushed the death toll among Israeli troopers to 221 since the beginning of the ground operation. Israeli media reported last week at least 4,000 troops have become disabled. Palestinian sources say that a regime undercounts its losses amid fear of the Israeli public anger. Now, from Dublin, I'm joined by Asad Abushar, Palestinian academic and activists. Good to have you with us, Asad. So you hear more and more fatalities on the part of the IOF troopers. What could this signify after almost 10 days of this genocidal war and Palestinian resistance fighters are even more strongly, fighting off and imposing more damage and also taking more Israeli invading troops' lives?
You see that Israelis are moving from defeat to defeat, from a disgraceful defeat to an ignominious defeat, simply because these European Zionists were transplanted in Palestine have no right and no cause to fight for, but the Palestinians, the owners of the land, have every cause to fight for their own land and to liberate their land from the Zionist occupiers who came from across the border, who were supported by the Americans and by the Europeans and by British and the Anglo-Saxons. And this is why we fight for our own land, to liberate our own land, because this is our own land. We belong. They do not have a sense of belonging to this strange land to them, because it is not their own land. They came from all over the world just to occupy and to invade and to settle. So they will end up like any colonialism, like any imperialism, like any occupiers. They will end up in defeat, and they will leave sooner or later Palestine, and the Palestine is for the Palestinians. But unfortunately, you see, because they are being supported by Europe and they are supported by America, and then, of course, there are these zealots and the ultra-religious and ultra-right and Zionists who fought for their own ideology, for their own myths. They are there, so there are, of course, differences and splits even among the political leaders and the military leaders, and they exchange accusations. And at the end of the day, because they are divided, and they cannot achieve any of the objectives or of the goals of this war, I think at the end of the day, they will leave Gaza and Gaza will emerge victorious, simply because the war is not against Hamas, it's against the Palestinian people. And all the Palestinian people are quite determined to remain in Palestine, to remain in their own land, and to defeat their own enemies, and to support the resistance and to turn against their occupiers and their Zionist invaders.
Okay, appreciate that. Asad Abu Shah, Palestinian academic and activist in Dublin. Now, day 109 of the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, Khan Yunis, the largest city in the south, has been the focus of the regime's latest attacks. Some 190 people have been killed in the past day, almost a third of them in Khan Yunis. Israeli forces have encircled the city, launching an air raid on areas around Nasser Hospital. The death toll since early October is nearing 25,500. The UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees says the telecommunications and internet service in Gaza have been down for the past 7 days. That's the longest since October 7. The blackout prevents people from accessing life-saving information and impedes humanitarian response. Israel has reportedly offered to Hamas a two-month pause in the onslaught in Gaza in exchange for all Israeli captives held by the Palestinian resistance groups. U.S. news website Axios has reported Israel has forwarded the proposal via Qatar and Egypt. It does not include an agreement to end the war, but points to a multi-phase deal on releasing the captives. Unnamed Israeli officials have been cited as saying an undetermined number of Palestinian detainees would also be freed. And Israeli media has also confirmed the proposal. This amid growing pressure and criticism Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been facing over his failure to bring captives back home. Some 250 captives were taken by Hamas following the Al-Aqsa flood operation. Hamas exchanged 80 of them for 240 Palestinian prisoners during a pause in the war last month. A Palestinian said that many of 130 captives still held in Gaza have been killed in Israeli strikes.
Over 100 days into the U.S.-Israeli war on Gaza, over 100 days of death and destruction for a regime which indiscriminately targets any moving thing anywhere in the war-ridden strip, be it residential buildings, medics, journalists, hospitals, or schools, an all-out war against the Palestinian territory from air, sea, and land, killing over 25,000 people, most of them innocent women and children. The Israeli aggression has been repeatedly described as not just a war, but a genocide and an attempt at the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. The bloodthirsty regime, however, has failed to reach any of the goals it has stated to justify its ongoing bloodshed, annihilating Hamas, setting free scores of captives held in Gaza, and pushing Palestinians out of their ancestral lands. On the ground, Palestinian fighters have inflicted heavy losses, both on the regime's military hardware and on IOF troopers. Back in the occupied territories, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing growing domestic outrage over his failure in the war and in securing the release of nearly 130 captives held by Hamas, both from ordinary people.
On the morning of October 7th, this government and this Prime Minister totally failed us. After 107 days, we are demanding that they fix the failure.
And a widening rift within Israel's political and military establishment. Israeli cabinet minister and former military chief Gadi Eisenkot is only one of the Israeli officials that have recently dismissed any achievement in Gaza. Eisenkot says the military operation in Gaza has failed to bring the captives back, arguing that the only solution is a deal with Hamas.
That it's impossible in the near future to restore the hostages alive without a deal.
Eisenkot's words contradicts a previous statement by Benjamin Netanyahu that rejects conditions presented by Hamas to end the war and release captives that would include Israel's complete withdrawal and leaving Hamas in power in Gaza. Meanwhile, growing protests have been held on a weekly basis in Israel, calling on the regime to take action to secure the release of their loved ones. Such demands, however, have fallen on deaf ears. With the war in its fourth month now, public opinion has shifted further against Netanyahu, leading to louder calls for leadership changes and the possibility of an early election. In the coming days, a Knesset meeting will be held to discuss a no-confidence motion against the motion, submitted by the opposition Labour Party, accuses Netanyahu of failing to make necessary decisions to get the captives freed. As protests reverberate through a cabinet already rattled by massive demonstrations in 2023, the question looms: will Netanyahu heed the voices of the people, or will he prioritize his own political pursuit over their demands? Perhaps it will take a new election for the Israelis to make their voices heard, an early election that would topple the hard-right premier after over 16 years in office.
Moving now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli settlers have committed yet another act of violence against Palestinians by vandalizing their property. The settlers attacked a Palestinian car dealer in Ramallah, setting fire to a building, causing extensive damage. Recently, the EU also warned against an upsurge of settler terrorism in the West Bank. According to Israeli sources, only 3% of investigations into settler violence ended in a conviction between 2005 and 2023. Israeli occupation forces have shot and arrested a female Palestinian near a settlement in the West Bank. They have also prevented ambulances from taking her to a hospital. A correspondent, Mona Kandel, joined us from Ramallah a short time ago with details on that.
Israeli forces, they opened fire at this Palestinian woman, and they left her bleeding on the ground. Palestinian ambulances rushed to the area. However, the Israeli forces prevented the Palestinian ambulances to come close to the entrance of the settlement of Pesigot, and they ordered them to leave. At the same time, they left this the female Palestinian on the ground bleeding, and later they arrested her. Israeli forces claimed that a female Palestinian arrived at the settlement of Pesigot, or let's say at the entrance of the settlement of Pesigot, that is East Albiri, a city near Ramallah, and she attempted to stab Israeli soldiers there. This is the Israeli military story, and we cannot confirm if she was really trying to carry out an anti-Israeli operation to stab Israeli soldiers or not.
Now, in Lebanon, Hezbollah resistance movement says it has launched missile strikes on the Israeli army's northern command center. The attack is a response to the recent Israeli assassinations and repeated attacks on civilians in Lebanon and Syria. A correspondent in southern Lebanon says that Israeli spying flights over the region have reduced significantly, and that might have something to do with Hezbollah's attack on the Israeli base.
The most significant operation today was that against the Meroun air base. And we saw that right after Hezbollah targeted successfully the Meroun air base on one of the highest peaks, like we said, in northern Palestine, we saw that there was a significant decrease in the air flights over Lebanon. And so did Hezbollah really succeed in cutting down when it came to the control of the air base in Meroun specifically, that they really target and hurt the infrastructure of that base? That is a question that needs to be posed and could possibly be positive, as analysts are saying that there could actually be very heavy casualties inside that base. As we know, since the beginning of the confrontation, this base has been hit and targeted twice by Hezbollah. The first time, they inflicted heavy losses. We're talking about more than 20 rockets that actually hit that base. And despite the fact that the Israelis said that they have a backup plan and a backup system to be used over there, we don't know if Hezbollah also targeted the backup system today. Of course, that could be one of the main scenarios, and this is why we saw a decrease in the overflights, whether from the drones or even the fighter jets over southern Lebanon. Even the shelling seems to have diminished. It's not clear whether that also helped in the fact in decreasing and not allowing the Israelis basically to have enough surveillance to be able to target southern Lebanon.
The U.S. and the U.K. have launched a new round of air raids on Yemen.
The U.S. and U.K. conducted a new series of airstrikes targeting 8 positions in the capital Sana'a. Despite the Yemeni attack on the U.S. ship, the U.S. military denies it, asserting continuous communication with the Ocean Jazz throughout its journey.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out a military operation targeting an American military cargo ship, Ocean Jazz, in the Gulf of Aden using appropriate naval missiles. The Yemeni armed forces affirm that retaliation against American and British attacks is inevitable and any new aggression will not go unpunished.
Military experts believe that the fresh airstrikes against Yemen contradict U.S. claims that the Yemeni attack is false.
Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian is in New York to attend a Security Council meeting on the situation in the Middle East. Ahead of that, top Iran diplomats said that Tehran had warned the U.S. and the U.K. about the ramifications of their strikes on Yemen and that the move was a strategic mistake.
We had sent a message to Americans and issued a serious warning against the joint U.S.-U.K. aggression against Yemen, that it is a threat to peace and stability in the region and risks intensifying the conflict. Satellite images showed the time the U.S. and Britain was carrying out aerial strikes on Yemen. Some 230 commercial vessels and oil tankers were sailing through the Red Sea. That means they had well received the message of Yemenis that their only targets are ships bound for Israeli ports, not others. Last week, during a meeting with British Foreign Secretary David Cameron in Davos, I clearly told him that their actions against Yemen are a strategic mistake that could escalate tensions in the Red Sea.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution is urging Muslim countries to cut vital lifelines of the Tel Aviv regime over its war in Gaza. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized the authorities of Muslim countries over their standpoints on the Gaza war. He said that those countries are talking about issues like ceasefire, despite knowing that it is out of their reach. The ceasefire, as Iran's leader says, is in the hands of the evil Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei called on Islamic countries to cut their economic and political ties with Israel and stop helping the regime. He said that despite hardships, the Palestinian nation will ultimately emerge victorious. And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast.
The Conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. On this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at concerns around police corruption and media freedom. Our special guest is an award-winning journalist who's been at the centre of recent controversy regarding clandestine efforts by both the police and security services in attempts to access his confidential sources. But before we do, let's get a rundown on what seems to be a recurring theme within policing institutions.
In 2014, Theresa May, the then British Home Secretary, commissioned a public inquiry into allegations that undercover police officers had spied on the family of Stephen Lawrence during their campaign to compel police to investigate the racist murder of their son. May called the revelations profoundly shocking and disturbing. Retired Judge Sir John Mitting was appointed to examine the conduct of officers who'd spied on more than 1,000 political groups between 1968 and at least 2010. In June, Mitting's first report was published, arising out of the inquiry's work and what has now become known as the Spy Cop scandal. It also followed revelations that undercover officers were regularly involved in long-term sexual relationships with women during this time. At least four of the undercover officers are known or alleged to have fathered children with women they met during their work. In July this year, more revelations have been uncovered, this time with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, into allegations that they had obtained the authorisation to access telephone records of journalist Barry McCaffrey, after he approached the PSNI's press office in 2013 with questions for a story he was working on about alleged corruption in the police force. McCaffrey was later arrested along with fellow journalist Trevor Burney after a documentary they were both involved in exploring the role of police collusion into the deaths of six civilians in Loughlin Island in 1994 uncovered a cover-up into the killings. These latest allegations once again shine a spotlight into a police force that has been at the centre of a number of controversies since it was reformed and renamed following the Patton Inquiry's recommendations in 2001.
As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest is award-winning journalist Barry McCaffrey. Many of you might remember Barry from the film No Stone Unturned, an explosive exposé that shone the spotlight on British state collusion in the massacre of six civilians who were watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy at the World Cup in June 1994. Instead of Barry's investigative work imploring the police to examine the findings and prosecute the suspects, he and fellow journalist Trevor Burney became the focus of police attention. This led to both men being arrested in August 2018, only to be later vindicated and awarded damages. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
Firstly, Barry, how did you become a journalist?
Just by chance, Sean. I had work experience at school. I was lucky enough to end up in the Irish News. You know, it was 1985. Computers hadn't come in then. It was still typewriters and Tippex and things like that. Then it's during summer holidays, I would have volunteered for the Irish Times. It used to be in Phantom House in Belfast, and ended up working on building sites in Jersey in the late 80s and early 90s, and eventually came home, was doing a night class just for the headspace to do something, and somebody ended up saying that they were going to do a journalist course, and I just followed them. So it was just always by chance,
Barry, we're going to talk a wee bit about your work on the film No Stone Unturned, but before we do that, we're going to have a wee look at the trailer for the film.
The World Cup Finals. I'd say the biggest day in Irish international soccer history.
Slaughter in Loughlin Island as loyalist terrorists shoot 11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television.
I just remember Mum saying to us that bad men had come into the pub and they'd shot six people, and Ali was dead.
Did you see anything?
No.
The
getaway car was discovered the morning after the attack.
There was just a sense that something wasn't right.
Somebody somewhere helped these people cover this up.
We were thwarted all the time. Every question we asked, we were told, we can't tell you that, that's national security.
They were absolutely ruthless.
I'll never forget their words, we will leave no stone unturned, and those words ring in my ear to this day, because I don't think they ever left a stone, never mind turned it.
So I was briefed to go down to Belfast and interview several people. What was unusual is that I was told who I could speak to, who I couldn't speak to, what they would be saying, but just as importantly, what they wouldn't be saying.
Certainly the bigger picture was there was this gang in operation and they were involved in serious criminality.
Obviously there was things going on above my head.
The paper trail will lead to the British government and they cannot allow that to happen.
The police were saying the car was destroyed. I thought, hold on, the largest physical exhibit in the case and you've destroyed it?
10 years with no information, we were kept in the dark.
They knew all along about the dirty war.
You're taking me into an area that I don't really want to go to.
I can't take the risk.
If I can hit somebody early enough and there's a weak one amongst this team, they might start tumbling.
How come they didn't do it?
Good question.
I really do believe it goes as far up to the right to the top.
It still gets me every time, Barry, every time I see a trailer or a piece of the film or the film itself, you know, just what the families went through, the victims went through, and, you know, the events that evening were horrendous, but the events leading from that and the way the police didn't investigate still leaves you with more questions than answers, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah, especially for the families, you know, nearly 30 years later, they still... the only answers they've got is they found them out themselves, you know, and they've had to drag the RUC and the PSNI, you know, kicking and screaming into courts to try and get any truth whatsoever. And, you know, that quest, that challenge still goes on. You know, the PSNI seem to be more interested in protecting, you know, the man who they say was the killer, rather than giving the families justice.
Mm-hmm. And tell us just a bit more about the film. How did you become involved in the film itself? What had happened?
Well, it went back to, so for the first 10 years, from 94 to 2005, the families kept a dignified silence. They didn't do any media. They didn't speak at all, because the police had told them, leave it with us, you know, we will leave no stone unturned, you know, and they put their trust in the police, which you would do in, you know, if you lived in Dublin or London or Glasgow, you trust, it's supposed to be a police service, somebody who serves the public, protects the public. So, like every decent person, the families believed that, you know, the police were their best option. And then in 2005, they realised that they'd been told lies for 10 years. And through Niall Murphy, their solicitor, they agreed to speak for the first time. And they did that through myself with the Irish News. And Niall and the families had tried to do documentaries with the BBC, but the BBC had told them that they weren't interested in legacy cases anymore. And it was just a chance meeting between Trevor and Niall and myself. And Trevor said, well, why don't we do something? That because we were naming the killers or the people who the PSNI said carried out the murders, we were concerned that we would be injuncted, and their identities or the role that they played would never be exposed.
So incredibly, Barry, after all that had been exposed and what had been seen within the film and the expectations that would have been there, you were arrested along with Trevor Burney.
Yes, Trevor and myself were arrested on the 31st of August 2018. To go back, when the film premiered, we expected a reaction from the PSNI. probably naively, we expected the PSNI to say, we'll look at the allegations in this film and, you know, we'll reopen the investigation. And if we find that they are true, you know, we'll go after the killers. And if it's not, the filmmakers will be discredited. But instead, what they did was they did say that they would reopen the investigation, but it was to find out who our sources were, and that was a scary moment, or you started to realise this is a bit strange. You're not going after the killers anymore. You're shooting the messenger. And that was that led on for a year, and we had our concerns about what would happen, but we never thought that we would be arrested. The normal tried and tested method that the relationship between the police and any police force and journalists or filmmakers, if the police believe you have information that they believe could help solve a crime or whatever, they go to court and they look for a production order from a judge, and they go into court, and the journalists or the filmmakers go into court, and you argue the issue out in front of a judge, and a judge decides, and that's the way it should have been. That's the way anywhere else in the world that it happens. That's not the way it happens here. So on the 31st of August 2018, 7 a.m., so I look down the stairs and I see this blue boiler suit, this figure in a blue boiler suit, at the front door. And it's at that stage you think, right, that's either one or two people. That's either the UVF or the killer coming to shoot us, or it's the police. And you have a decision to make at that stage, do you run back in and hide underneath the bed, or, do you let them put the door in, or what do you do? So I decided, I'd just go down the stairs and sort of front it out, whatever it was, and I was sort of delighted when it was a cop at the door, it felt like hugging him. We arrive at Musgrave Street Police Station, and there's two levels to Musgrave Street. There's the ground level was for the shoplifters and, somebody got drunk and made a fool of themselves or whatever. And then the second level, the penthouse, that's the anti-terror suite. That's the Bin Laden suite. And I was hoping we were going down into the shoplifters, but no, we ended up going up in the lift. And then you're stripped, and you've DNA taken, your fingerprints and that. And all of that, and then you're putting your shoes are off, and you're putting the cell or whatever, and then you have a wee cry to yourself, you get in underneath the blanket, and you just all you want's your mummy, and that went on. Shocking at that stage to see that they were there. The main prosecution witness against us was the man who they say killed six people, and that's how perverse the PSNI, the investigation was. They weren't trying to find, they weren't trying to find justice for the Loughran Island families. They were using the killer against us to try and, to try and shut us up.
Mental. It just illustrates very clearly how dysfunctional this place is, doesn't it? But you've also then, Barry, because it just doesn't end there, and the raid and the arrest and all the rest of it, you've recently been at the centre of a police spying scandal where the Investigative Powers Tribunal, set up to investigate complaints against the intelligence services and public authorities, have uncovered a further case going back to 2013.
So we initially thought that it was going to be about Loughran Island. That's that's what we were really interested in, but the IPT came back and said no, you were spied on actually 5 years earlier in 2013, and we're going to investigate this case or this incident first before we get to Loughran Island, and it was only by cross-referencing the dates that we realised what the case was about, because they don't tell you what you were being spied on. And it was only through sheer luck that when I cross-referenced the dates, I realised that actually what it was a story that I was doing about police corruption.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, investigative journalist, Barry McCaffrey.
Thank you, Sean.
So obviously all of that is going to have an impact on public confidence in the PSNI. Do you think that extends to academia or trade unions or other professions as well?
I have no doubt that what has happened to Trevor and myself, we're just the tip of the iceberg. We have met with a broad range of people from academia, NGOs, and right across society. And what has been most alarming is that this isn't a one-off. We have no doubt it's happening to journalists. They're spying not only on journalists, but we met one person who was a member of the policing board, who was a civilian member of the policing board, and they were able to tell us that the exact same thing had happened to them. The chief constable needs to front up now and tell us, this isn't Stasi Germany. It's not supposed to be Stasi Germany. A police service is supposed to serve the public. They're not supposed to spy on, especially people who are only doing their job. Journalists, we are entrusted by society to hold government and government agencies to account. Journalism isn't a crime.
Mm-hmm. And how damaging overall do you think this has been to public confidence?
I think this is just the latest in a long line of, self-inflicted mistakes that the PSNI have committed on themselves. How is society supposed to have confidence in policing when we now know that police are, what have the PSNI to hide? Why are they spying on us? Why didn't they come out and say, sorry, there's an allegation of police corruption and we're investigating it? Mm-hmm. Why did they, and why are they still trying to hide through these secret courts?
Yeah, Barry, I suppose many of us grew up with police and army raids on our homes in the 70s and 80s, but the ones post-Good Friday Agreement were nearly worse because it was a different environment in which they were happening. But that raid on you and your family was a terrible ordeal. What impact did it have?
It's like a boomerang. It keeps on coming back. I'd be very open about it challenges with mental health or whatever. You have to talk to people. You have to cope with it. Some people just you can compartmentalize it and put it away. And it did. Listen, it takes a heavy toll.
And after all that's happened, Murray, how do you view? Do you still have confidence in the police?
We have to bring this thing right to the very end to defend press freedom, because if we don't fight it to the last, stretch, they'll do this again and again. We have to make sure that what they have done never happens again. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not, and the only way we can do that is if they are held to account. So they can't have these secret hearings and, closed-door hearings that we don't get into, that our solicitors don't get into. The PSNI can tell whatever lies they want in there, and nobody's there to challenge it because we're not allowed in. If we are going to restore confidence in policing, it has to be open and it has to be transparent. And the PSNI have to come out and say, sorry, we spied on, so many, whether it's journalists, NGOs, politicians, ordinary people in the street. That's what the Stasi had to do. The files were opened. That's what, so if the PSNI have files on every member in society that they shouldn't have, if they have been spying on the people in society, well, let's open the files. It was good enough for Germany. It was good enough for South Africa. But the home of democracy, British democracy. If this is a democratic society, let's open the files. Because if they have done nothing wrong, they have nothing to fear of. That's, you know, that's the thing. Either they have done wrong or they haven't done wrong. And if they haven't done something wrong, let's have it open in court.
Well, Pari, listen, I want to thank you for coming in again. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Michelle.
We want to wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. This week, we took us to Dublin to have a look at the Moore Street campaign, where a small number of activists have been challenging the Irish government to maintain the cultural integrity of an area described by the National Museum of Ireland as the most important site in modern Irish history.
In April 1916, the course of Irish history changed forever. In a rebellion that witnessed hundreds of armed revolutionaries take on the might of the British Empire, a call for a national right to freedom and sovereignty was read out by one of the leaders of the rising, Padraig Pearse, as he stood with an armed guard on the steps of the GPO in Dublin. After a number of days of pitched street battles and heavy bombardments by the British Army, a decision was made to evacuate what now had been the centre of the insurgency at the General Post Office in O'Connell Street. With the building now in flames, the remaining Republican defenders made their way to 5 Moore Street and began tunnelling from house to house along the street. The following morning, one of the leaders, James Connolly, was wrapped in blankets and carried through the holes they forced in the walls to number 16. In a small room, Sean McDermott, Padraig Pearse, Joseph Plunkett, James Connolly and Tom Clark discussed the limited options open to them, including rushing the British Army barricade on Parnell Street. Tom Clark, who went to look at the situation, returned to tell the leaders that it could not succeed. The leaders came to the reluctant conclusion that surrender was the only choice open to them to avoid further loss of life. Julia Grennan, Winifred Kearney and Elizabeth O'Farrell had stayed throughout Easter week in the GPO. O'Farrell was now tasked with a dangerous responsibility, going to the British lines where General Lowe informed her that he would only accept unconditional surrender. A short time later, Padraig Pearse, accompanied by O'Farrell and wearing his military coat and hat, left the Moore Street headquarters of the Provisional Government to meet General Lowe. The insurrection was now over. All signatories to the proclamation were later executed by the British government. 107 years later, and this historical and iconic battlefield area is under threat from corporate interests. Commercial plans have been drawn up to bulldoze one of Ireland's most important historical sites, but not without a fight. The Moore Street Preservation Trust, led by the relatives of the signatories to the 1916 Proclamation of the Irish Republic, have been pressuring the Irish government to commit to preserve the site in order to instead develop the area into a 1916 cultural corridor in the heart of Dublin. Rather than witness the further gentrification of the capital city, the group aims to enrich and preserve the quarter, reflecting the aims and ideals of the men and women of 1916. US filmmaker Ron Maxwell describes it well. Battlefields are looking glasses into the world of our ancestors. Standing on their earth under the skies is to be at one with them and to viscerally understand humanity's connections across time. The generation that won independence lives in the ideas we honour, the architecture we preserve, and the battlefields we can yet save. As it now stands, the future of one of Ireland's most iconic historical sites is in the balance. A decision by the planning board is imminent. What will the future hold?
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Barry McCaffrey, and my co-host, Michelle Gildenew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
Illallah, la ilaha illallah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, we were discussing the different status of the supplicants while invoking the Almighty Allah. When Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, was being thrown into the fire, Gabriel asked him, "Do you want me to do you anything?" And this Prophet replied, "As from you, no. Allah is sufficient for me, and He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the protector." Then Michael came and said, "If you want, I can put out the fire. The sources of the waters and rains are in my hand." But Abraham said, "No, I do not want that." Then the angel of the wind came and said to him, "If you like, I will fly the fire." And Abraham said, "No, I do not want." And then Gabriel came to Abraham and said, "Invoke Allah." And Abraham said, "It suffices me that He knows about my state." Dear listeners, in the previous episode, we fully discussed the third stage of the supplicants, the status of the supplicant who realizes that the Almighty Allah suffices him. He knows that he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, as the creator of the universe, as the absolute cause, as the creator of him and whatever there is in the world, knows best what suits him. So, of course, he will resort to the Almighty Allah and no one else, but he realizes that the Almighty Allah suffices him. That is the point of this story of Prophet Abraham. This is why Prophet Abraham says that Almighty Allah suffices me in the first level. And in the next one, the fact that Almighty Allah knows about my status suffices me as well. So this stops him from turning towards the Almighty Allah for any kind of need, any kind of low desire. This is the kind of stage the prophets, this great prophet, Prophet Abraham, the Ark Prophet, had reached.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti op onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ob kamju tishnagi ovar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you.
It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
Dear listeners, up to now we have mentioned three stages of the status of the supplicants. In the first stage, the supplicant is only worried about his own request and want. In the second, the supplicant is looking for the contentment of the Almighty Allah because he knows that he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the one who likes the supplicant to practice supplication. In the third stage, the supplicant is aware of the fact that the Almighty Allah suffices him, so that stops him from calling out to him at any time for any kind of low desires. So, in the fourth stage, we understand that the supplicant has reached this position of an individual who has no want or desire, because he knows the secrets of the creation. In this stage, in this level, the servant has understood the secrets of creation. He has understood the divine determination and the past and the present. He is aware of all. This is, in fact, the position of the prophets and the infallible imams. This is not the normal position we're discussing here, something which is within reach of all the servants. These sincere servants of God are so obedient to God that they can know the poison in the water they drink, and they realize that the dates in Ma'mun's court are contaminated with poison. This is because they believe in the divine destiny. They know that this destiny is not changeable. Therefore, for them, the only available is obeying God. They know that they have no other choice except believing in the Lord and following Him, and of course, letting others in His direction. Before His departure from Mecca towards Karbala, Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, وكأني بأوصالي تقطعها أسلان الفلوات بين النواويس وكربلاء. As if I see the beasts of the deserts, the armies of Kufa, he meant, in the land between Nawawis and Karbala. It is as if I see them cutting off my limbs apart. So this is what Imam Hussein alayhi salam saw. Not only Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but his beloved and honorable father, Imam Ali alayhi salam, too had referred to this matter. And he pointed this out years ago. And for this exact reason, even at the last stage, looking at the sky, Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, Sabran ala qada'ika ya Rabb. He said, we are patient before the fate you have determined for us, O our Lord. La ilaha siwak ya ghiyath al-mustaghithin. Even at that stage, he said, there is no God save you, O you, the relief of the yearners. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi وبركاته.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.